Well, the 10-3 Cardinals came into town angry today. I mean, after all, they're facing the 1-11-1 Lions. The point spread is sky high. Of course, the Cards are going to come in and dispatch of the Lions quick, fast, in a hurry. And, Bill, as Lee Corso would say, not so fast, my friend.
Not so fast, my friend. Not at all.
It was a thorough, I mean that, a thorough victory. Anybody who watched that game today, Bill, the Lions were the better team today. Simply put, no ifs, ands, or buts. Both sides of the ball, they got the job done. They knock off the Cardinals 30-12 today.
Yeah, what a statement by the Lions today. And as you said, it was no fluke. There was nothing gimmicky about it. It was in-your-face football. They won the line of scrimmage. They converted when they had to. They stopped them when they had to. A couple key turnovers. And that's how you win football games. And I, you know, people were going to say, well, that's the shock of the day and blah, blah, blah. Well, not in the NFL. I mean, the Lions, how many games went down to the last possession?
Yep.
How many one possession losses had they had where literally a play or two changes those games? And then I think, and it was overlooked. I didn't hear anybody really referring much to it this past week, but when you look at the game Arizona played on Monday night, you know, they've been told all year, they're the best team in the NFC. They're playing the Rams, you know, the preseason favorite in the NFC West. And so they got everything on a silver platter, home game. The country's watching. The Rams had some injuries and COVID issues. And then the day of the game, the Rams lose two key players to COVID issues, Jalen Ramsey and Higbee, the tight end. So the mindset of the Cardinals had to be, boy, this we're going to get this done. I mean, we're going to not only clinch the playoff last Monday night, we're going to look at home field here. And the Rams and Matthew Stafford took it to them. And then so they're flying cross country to play the, as you say, the one win Lions. And as much as we've always said, hey, the Lions are paying their players too. And those players are the best, you know, of a select group in the world. But, you know, the Cardinals, I don't know that any amount of coaching could have prepared them for the Lions team to play today because they played exceptionally well.
The defense, I mean, just getting after Kyler Murray the way they did, Bill. And, you know, that's one thing. I was just talking to Chris Renwick about this. Listen, it was a historically bad defense last year. There's still a lot of work to be done. Make no mistake about it. But watching this defense progress as it has this year, you have to give Brad Holmes and Coach Campbell and obviously Aaron Glenn a heck of a lot of credit to get this defense to where it's at right now. Look, it's not going to remind anybody of the Monsters of the Midway or anything like that, the Doomsday, the Steel Curtain. But I'll tell you what, it's a pretty good defense right now.
I mean, they've had moments where they've been exceptional, really. And when you look at the patchwork defense that Aaron Glenn has had to put together, it's even more impressive. If you go back to the three deep, at the beginning of the season and who played today. I mean, you might have 50% of the guys in there, maybe. And it's all about on game day. It's preparation, you know, through the off season, through training camp, through the preseason games. And then every week during the season. And Brad Holmes has got some guys off the street that he weren't even playing, you know, this entire season. And it just goes, you know, the old adage that I have believed forever, there's guys on the street. They're going to help a team win a game, you know, some Sunday during the season. And there were a couple with the Lions that did that today, no doubt. So hats off to them. And of course you hear the naysayer saying, well, they lost the number one draft pick. You know what? You're in this business to win.
Yep.
And you can't quantify how good that win makes those players and how much it will serve and the equity they'll get from it moving forward. along with the coaching staff and everybody within the organization. So that was a great win.
I'm a firm believer in losses are going to come organically. They're either going to happen or they aren't. You can't help it along, you know, on game day. And none of these guys, I've heard Lomas Brown say this 10,000 times, not a one of these guys are thinking about draft picks.
No.
They're not thinking about April. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about what they have to do to beat the Cardinals, period, end of story. And I'm with you there. Of course, in a perfect world, it'd be great if the Lions had, you know, the one pick and you know, they got as high of a pick as they could from the Rams and everything. But don't tell these guys not to go out there and give everything they have, because that doesn't line up with Dan Campbell's mentality either.
No, I mean, think about what you just said. I mean, the contradiction there, because the guys playing today at Ford Field for the Lions, they don't want to hear about any draft picks coming to take their jobs. And I think there's an interesting reality to how well the Lions have played in some of those losses, and certainly in today's game this year, because I don't know what the percentage is, Sean, but there's a number of guys on one-year deals, and they're interviewing for a job every practice session and certainly every game. They're interviewing for that next contract. And I mean, anybody in any profession can relate to that. Okay, I'm going to work tomorrow, and if I don't do a good job, I may not go to work the next day. I might be done and not have a job on Tuesday. Well, that's how these guys approach it.
Yeah.
So not only are they trying to win today, but, you know, they're human. And the Lions, because of the reality of the rebuild and just the roster transformation this year, there's a lot of them on one-year deals, short-term deals. So that plays into it. That plays into it big time. And the effort's been impeccable all year.
Yeah. All year. Can't complain about that. Lions get the job done by a score of 30-12. Letting you know what else is going on right now, as we always do, in case you don't have a chance to see what's going on. The Packers are doing Packer things. Yeah. They have a 31-24 lead at Baltimore right now. Aaron Rodgers, well, he's doing Aaron Rodgers things. 23 of 31 for 268 yards and 3 touchdowns. The other late game, just a few ticks remaining in this one. The Bengals have a 15-10 lead over the Broncos. The Broncos with a 3rd and 24 from their own 11. So the Broncos looking to move to, or excuse me, the Bengals looking to move to 8-6. Broncos would fall to 7-7. So, by the way, the other 4 o'clock game this afternoon, the Niners knock off the Falcons by a score of 31-13. Niners improve to 8-6 tonight. Should be a good one. Saints and Buccaneers down in Tampa. And then, of course, the craziness, Bill, of the next couple of days.
Yeah.
Raiders, Browns at 5 tomorrow. Vikings, Bears at 8:15. And then we roll with Tuesday games. Seahawks and Rams and the Washington football team and the Eagles. Such are the times that we're living in, Bill. And with everything going on with COVID, at least the National Football game isn't losing games yet.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's so important this time of year. And I got to believe in a very real way that football fans across the country kind of like the idea that they're getting a couple games on Monday, a couple games on Tuesday. You know, we got Christmas games. I mean, I think sometimes you back into things. And I'm not saying that this is going to be, you know, the real deal moving forward with respect to, you know, Tuesday games and what have you. But last year, I believe, was the first year ever that the NFL played a game on every single day of the week.
That's crazy. Because of,
crazy. But I don't think football fans are complaining too much. Maybe the fans in those cities that had their travel disruptive, obviously, you can empathize with them. But football fans, you know, they have a couple to choose from the next couple of days, and that's a good thing.
And, you know, if you're a fan of the NFL, you got to love this week, because to your point, not only do you have the Tuesday game, you have a day off, and then you have a Thursday game. Everybody gets Christmas Eve off, and Then they're back at it with games on Christmas Day and, of course, the 26th and the 27th. So a good stretch if you're an NFL fan, no doubt about that. We're going to go down memory lane. There are two different Lion games, Bill, when you were working for the Lions, one at home, one on the road, that happened to take place on Christmas Day. Yeah. Some also legendary games in the past on Christmas Day, so we'll talk about that. Got to touch on the Division II champions as well in college football, the Ferris State Bulldogs, Tony Anise, and the Bulldogs get it done last night. So much to do. Glad you could join us on a Sunday night right here. It's Gridiron Wrap on 760 WJR. Well, as we were talking about just before we went into the break, and our fine producer here tonight, Eric Dortch, tells us his wife is a Bulldog. Bill, congratulations to Ferris State. Getting it done in convincing fashion last night and winning the D2 championship.
How awesome is that, Sean, for those Bulldogs? They were close a couple years ago, and you talk about domination and just what a performance. And, you know, perhaps the the story of all stories in college athletics this year, when you think about the 12-month reality that Jared Bernhardt had for Ferris State, coming in as the player of the year at Division I Maryland in college lacrosse, which we know is as tough a sport as there is. You talk about physical toughness, mental toughness, you know, I mean, lacrosse is incredible. And then because he loves football and he hadn't played in 5 years, right? He comes in and does what he does for Ferris. I gotta believe that there's a lot of D1 with the transfer. I don't know how it impacts lacrosse, but what he did is going to change a lot of recruiting approaches, not only, you know, at the Division I or Division II football level, but NFL scouts are going to say, wow, let me see what he did. I mean, against the best competition in Division II. And there's a lot of Division II players in the NFL. It's all relative. And he dominated. I guess he looks like he's going to win the Division II Heisman Award. And, you know, can those skills translate to the NFL? I mean, they obviously translated to the best of Division II football. And what a great win. And again, Sean, it sort of underscores our belief that Michigan's the capital of college football. We got a champion on the other side of the state.
You know, Bill, it's so funny. I'm so glad that you brought up the lacrosse aspect, because when I got a chance to see him play this year, obviously doing the Wayne State games, he looked like a pinball out there. I kid you, when guys hit him, he looked like a guy that was playing lacrosse while he was playing football. He looked like a pinball. He'd take a hit, he'd absorb it, he'd stay on his feet. A tough kid, no doubt about that. Yeah. And it's been very interesting to watch Ferris take this, you know, this step up. It's been a process, but Tony Anise got it done. And, you know, in the last 10 years, Wayne State, you know, they had their run to get to the championship. I had a front row seat for it. Grand Valley has come close a couple times, but nobody from the GLIAC has been able to get there and win it in a while, and Ferris State did that last night. Just a great story, and you're right, Bill, just another reminder of how strong the game of football here is in our great state.
Right. And how about Coach Anise? He hadn't coached in college before, correct, Sean? He was at Muskegon, the Big Red, and had a dominating program there. And it just underscores – and we've talked about this, coaching is coaching, no matter what the level. There's a lot of phenomenal coaches at the high school level and the small college, D3, D2, NAIA, obviously all the way up. So if you can coach the game, you can coach the game. And for him to do what he did, coming from the high school ranks to D2 and have the success he had at Ferris, is just remarkable.
You know, it's interesting, Bill. I wanted to touch on another thing that we were talking about in the last segment, excuse me, and I'm sure that you'll have a unique perspective about it. So much has been said about the short week, you know, whether it be the Thanksgiving Day game, whether it be Monday night, and a lot of players in particular complaining about the Tuesday game this week and what an impact. Bill, in your years in the league, in particular, obviously here in Detroit,
yeah,
how much of a factor is that? You hear the players talk about it, but have you seen it? Sure, it's something that nobody wants to deal with, but have you seen teams affected adversely by it, or is it just more the we need that extra day to recoup?
Here's where I have seen it have an impact, but it's not what you might think. I remember a Thanksgiving game. I forget what year it was, but Jeff Backus, who hadn't missed a start his entire career with the Lions, the game before Thanksgiving had an elbow. And if the game were on Sunday, he would have played. But he couldn't play on Thanksgiving, despite him practically busting down the coach's door to get out there and play. What a warrior that man was. So I've seen it where if the game was, you know, on Sunday and not Thursday night or not even Saturday, a player could have got back in time. But as far as playing on Thursday and even with the 17th game, I don't want to compare the USFL experience I had, you know, way back when to the NFL, but the USFL, we played 18 games and it was all relevant. It was all relative. Okay. Cause you know, you're playing against, you know, the opponents that have the same schedule, if you will, you know, the same physicality issues, if you will, for the most part. So I remember a few years ago when the talk started about the, about adding the 18th game or the 17th game. At one point, the thought was we would go just to 18, and then it got cut back to 17. But I remember suggesting at a league meeting or talking to some league personnel, has there ever been a study done on those teams that make the playoffs, which, you know, was close to half the teams in the league, and the propensity of injuries in the wild card round? Some teams play, you know, they don't get a week off other than the week before the Super Bowl. You know, they're finishing the regular season and playing three straight weeks. And there really was no significant increase in the injuries. It wasn't dramatic at all. It wasn't even an issue. So I think where it does potentially impact you is, you know, not getting guys back
sure.
for a game. But I also think, and I'm sure the league looks at this, you know, there's some ways to, you know, it would be wonderful if teams have played on Thursday night, were off the week before.
Yeah.
Had their bye the week before. I think that would be eminently fair and certainly speak to the safety issue. Whether or not that's possible with the intricacies to the scheduling, I'm not sure. But I know that, you know, the bottom line to the question, Sean, I haven't seen it in a way that would be alarming at all.
Good stuff. By the way, Bill, just in the time we were talking, the Ravens didn't score one touchdown. They scored two touchdowns. And for the benefit of people out there that
my God.
Just a few minutes ago, I told everybody out there that the Packers were up 31-17. The Ravens scored with 4:53 left to make it 31-24. Then Tyler Huntley just ran one in with 42 seconds left. Bill, they went for two and failed.
Oh, my God. It's the second time they did that.
Second time now. Oh, we've been on the air both times. They went for two and they failed. So with 42 seconds left, the Packers have a 31-30 lead over the Ravens.
Wow. It looks like almost the same play. Yeah. Wow.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing? That is amazing.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. So we'll wait and see how that plays out. Things that we're going to talk about, we are going to talk about some Christmas memories. And Bill, right. You can correct me if I'm wrong. There have only been two Lions games on Christmas, right?
That's my recollection. I believe you're right. Yep.
And, it's funny. We both remember them. We remember them for different reasons. Yeah. One happened before I was even in the business, but there's a special story behind that we'll share. And the cool thing about the the league on Christmas Day. Boy, you remember those games. At least I do. I tend to remember the games that are on Christmas Day because it's always kind of centered around the Christmas dinner as well. But we'll go down the memory lane, talk about the two Lions games, and Bill, some other games that might have a particular meaning to you or I for different reasons. I went into a fantasy football championship dinner dance one time, right in the middle of Christmas dinner. And it's funny. It was 17 years ago, and my family still mocks me for it. We'll get into that as well. He's Bill Keenis. I'm Sean Belegian. So glad you could join us. It's Sunday night right here on 760 WJR. You know, Bill and I, we're old-timers, okay? I mean, the memory goes back a long time and everything. And one of the things we were talking about during the break, and I'm sure many of you will remember this, really not that long ago, Bill, the NFL always concluded its season before Christmas. And it was interesting because there was one year that popped into my mind as we were having the conversation, and I had to go and double-check. The strike year was the that was the only time, because I remember plain as day watching games like after January 1st and going, this is weird. Yeah. This is regular season football that was happening. And of course, that was because the strike in 82. But yeah, the regular season was always over before Christmas.
It was, Sean. It was always over before Christmas. And that's why you don't have many Christmas Day game memories. But the one little note about the 82 season, the 82 season was going to end on December 26th, but because of the strike, the league added an extra game. So the league added a game that had been postponed during the regular season. So we played the final regular season game, which was only the ninth game of the year. There were only 9 regular season games played that year in January. As you said, you're right. The regular season, and the reason why, as I recall, during that 82 season, the strike, aside from the strike, that the games were going to end on the 26th had to do with when New Year's Day was and the bowl games. That's where when the Big Four were all on New Year's Day, and it was a TV issue, it was a broadcasting issue, and I think, quite frankly, the NFL acquiesced to some requests to try to allow the college bowl games to maintain their their prominence that they had back then, especially the Big Four on New Year's Day.
A guy that we talked about a few weeks back as being an underrated coach when you talk about great coaches, of course, that strike year, Joe Gibbs and the Redskins. Yeah. I think you have a little familiarity with that. Special team, that 82 team. And the thing I remember about that run is you always think about Riggins' run in the Super Bowl, but that image of RFK Stadium, the NFC Championship game against the Cowboys. Yeah. And literally the stadium was rocking. I remember as a kid, it was like, that must be the most unsafe, but you could literally see the stands rocking. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's true, Sean. And those were the seats that were portable for baseball because the Washington Senators used to play there. So those are the seats that were essentially on steel wheels, railroad tracks, if you will, and they would reconfigure the stadium for football. And they were rocking. And that stadium, RFK, only held 55,000. It was 55,045. It was sold out forever and a day. And the noise that those fans made was unbelievable. And I always would look at those old baseball stadiums because in the upper deck, most of them from that era, they had, the roof at the upper deck came over the seating. And I believe that just reverberated the sound back onto the field. And RFK was like that in some respects, where a lot of the upper deck seats were covered and the noise was just amazing. But that year was the year that we won the Super Bowl in Washington. And part of my PR duties was to advance the games. And back then, it was a different media world, a different reality to how you publicize the games. But somebody from the PR department, and I had that duty with Washington, would go to the, if we were on the road, I would go to that city, usually on a Tuesday, sometimes on a Wednesday, but primarily on Tuesday, and go to all the main newspapers in town, go to all the TV stations, carrying a big, you know, sort of luggage full of tape highlights, if you will, you know, go to the radio stations, try to line up interviews. I mean, literally trying to sell tickets and publicize the game. So as our season, you know, we had only had one loss during the regular season, and I was the main advance guy, and I loved it. I mean, I had a role with the team that I cherished, and I knew I had a part in the team. And I didn't really even think twice about the reality that I was going to be away for Christmas the first time in my life, because we played on the 26th. So I would be down there for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. The team would come in on the 25th, Christmas Day, and then play on the 26th. So, and we always had a traditional Italian Christmas Eve. Mm. And, you know, my grandmother, my mom, my uncles would cook all the fishes. And so it was just a big family celebration. And this was going to be my first one, not there. And I wanted to be there in my role with Washington, but I was still, gosh, I'm going to miss my family, blah, sure, blah, blah. So I called my counterpart from the Saints, and great guy, his name was Greg Suit. And I said, Greg, I don't want to sit in my hotel room on Christmas Eve. I'm going to be at the Marriott in the French Quarter. I want to do something. Do you guys have any relationships with Children's Hospital where I can dress up as Santa? I literally wanted to do that. I had done that a couple times in high school, sort of as a spoof, and I loved it. So, you know, long story short, what Greg put together was a visit that I would go on with him, and check this out, Sean, Kenny the Snake Stabler.
Wow.
Yeah. And George Rogers.
Superman. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Who can forget?
And so we went to these hospitals, to the wings for the kids, and the Saints got a bunch of toys together. We sang Christmas carols, you know, and it ended up being one of the best Christmas Eves I ever had. I never could have imagined that. But when you walked into those wards, and those kids literally, Sean, didn't have anybody that was visiting them on Christmas Eve. I mean, it was gut-wrenching, it was heartbreaking. And, you know, certainly when they saw the Snake and George and the there might have been another Saints player there as well. You know, they just lit up, and we gave them toys and what have you. So it turned out to be, like I said, a phenomenal Christmas Eve. One I to this day count as one of my greatest memories. So then the next morning, the team's coming in Christmas Day, probably around 2 o'clock or so. So I want to go to church. I want to go to the earliest mass I can in the French Quarter, right? So there's a big cathedral, old church in the French Quarter. And I talked to the hotel concierge about where it is and what time I should head down. So I think it was a 6 a.m. mass, maybe a 7 a.m. service. So I leave the hotel, and being in New Orleans on Christmas morning was weird because it was 55, 60 degrees, sure. You know, and I'm walking through the French Quarter. And as I'm stepping over literally homeless people, the contrast to that, and there were so many people literally sleeping on the sidewalks, and you hear the bells of all the churches ringing, and it was such an emotional contrast. It's like, wow, look at this picture. Look at this. And I, you know, I'm sure the numbers probably gotten a little exaggerated over the years, but I easily saw 30 to 40 people that were still asleep when I was walking to church. Wow. You know, so I get into the cathedral, and it was a beautiful service, you know, glorious old church. And then somehow, is this fitting? I don't know, but it sure makes for a good story. As we're exiting the church, there's all these policemen and police cars. Well, the collection baskets got ripped off. They took them, as I found out, you know, they took them all to the back of the church where the ushers were counting them. And a couple guys with guns came in and stole all the money. So sort of, you know, like, well, it's New Orleans, I guess.
New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah, quite a memory. We won the game, which was most important. And
that is great.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
You're going to have to tell me about this Italian Christmas Eve too. Oh, yeah. Is it the whole calamari. Seven fish thing? Is that?
My uncle Anthony used to make the best calamari and the sauces and oh my gosh. And it's an Italian tradition. And I'm not sure that they have to be seven, you know, specific fishes.
Yeah.
Just need to be seven different ones. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Really a neat deal.
That's such a special night. I think like so many families, it's such a special night in my family as well. And one of the things, Bill, that we don't know quite how it happened. It just did. Somehow, some way, Christmas Eve dinner ended up at my house, and it stayed at my house for the last 17 years. And
wow,
I'm not complaining. I love, I'm sure you know this. I love to smoke food and I love to cook and everything, but we were actually talking about it as a family. We're like, how did it start? I don't know. It just did. Yeah. Like everybody comes over my house and, you know, and it's funny. Sometimes we have 40 people here. Sometimes we have 20 people here, but
yeah,
it's always at our
house.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
it is.
That's a great thing.
So I love to hear what other people do. And the seven fish thing has always intrigued me to be sure.
When we were real young, when I was in grade school and even younger, one of my uncles, my Uncle Joe, would dress up as Santa and, you know, and nobody missed him. I mean, he'd show up and then he'd disappear. Then all of a sudden you'd hear something outside, you know, ho, ho, ho! And nobody was wiser to it. But it just made for great childhood memories for sure.
No doubt about it. And certainly before we're out of here, wish you, Bill, your whole clan, you and yours, everybody out there, have a wonderful Christmas.
Amen.
This is such a
Absolutely.
Special, special week. And for those of us with faith, it means the world
it
to
means,
us.
It
There's
sure
no
does.
Doubt about that.
Yeah.
I will talk about those
that.
Lions games when we come back. Some different Christmas Day memories.
Yeah.
Well, don't you go anywhere. Final segment of the show right here on 760 WJR. Well, about 9 minutes left in this, Bill. I know one of the games that sticks out in a lot of people's memory on Christmas Day. My dad told me stories of it, but that infamous Kansas City Chief Miami Dolphin game, was it 71? If I'm not mistaken, 71.
Right. Yeah.
I remember my dad telling me the game just kept going and going and going. And you have some memories of that one, huh?
I do. I just remember thinking it was so cool that, the NFL or the AFL, they were, you know, the AFC teams, AFL teams were playing a playoff game on Christmas Day. What a better, you know, way to spend part of your Christmas. And then the game became the longest game in history with overtime. And the game, as we started talking about it, and I said, oh, the Ed Podolak game. And Ed Podolak was a running back for the Chiefs. And he had one of the, you know, the most, you know, famous games any player had had up to that point. He had two touchdowns rushing. He had 85 yards rushing, 110 yards receiving. And then he had 154 yards in kick returns, including a 78 yarder. And he kept the Chiefs in that game. It was like whenever they needed a play, Ed Podolak made the play. Now, for all our Detroit fans from that era listening, guess who kicked the winning field goal?
Garrow, right?
Yes, sir. Garrow. Very good, Johnny. Yeah, you're a good boy this Christmas. Garrow, your Premian. Yeah, kicked 27-24, I think, was the final. But, what a game. What a game. Yeah,
you know, I know you were down there, Bill. The Miami game, 1994, the Lions traveled down to Miami to take on the Dolphins that day. And I remember that one because I think it was the first Christmas where both our sets of parents kind of sat back and said, all right, this is serious. This Sean Kristen, Kristen Sean thing is kind of serious. And we went to dinner over her house, and her mom grew up in a family where they didn't have the television on. And boy. Somehow I I talked her into leaving the television on so I could watch the Lions that day.
Oh boy.
And thus began a back and forth about that that continues to this very day. I'm not going to lie. We have fun with it. Boy. But Lions lose down in Miami that night, Bill. I'm sure you have some memories of that.
I do. That was a ESPN game. Mm-hmm. I think it was the only game on TV on Christmas Day. And the week before, we had beaten the Vikings to keep our playoff hopes alive. And going into that game in Miami, Barry needed like 180 yards to get to 2,000. Okay, that was really the first foray he had with 2,000 yards. So what I did, and there might have been one or two other people that knew about it, I had this Christmas dream, if you will, of us winning the game. And this would not have happened if we hadn't won the game. We winning the game. And Barry getting 2,000 yards. And I had T-shirts made up. And the idea, the hope was that at the end of the game, you know, with the coaches, with Wayne's approval, of course, Wayne knew about it. If we had the game in hand and Barry got the 2,000 yards, we were going to pass out the T-shirts and the players would wear them. And the T-shirt said, Barry Christmas, 2,000 yards, playoffs, 1994. And I still have a box of those somewhere. The other thing I remember about that game is the producer for that game, Fred Gadelli, who's been a career-long friend. He's now the producer for Sunday Night Football on NBC. Fred was producing, and the open for that game was they filmed Gregory Hines, the tap dancer. They filmed his feet, and they interspliced it with Barry's feet. And it was fabulous.
Wow.
And so they went back and forth between Barry and Gregory Hines. And I talked to Fred, you know, periodically over recently. And we always bring up that open. What a great open that was.
The other Christmas Day game. This one was at the Pontiac Silverdome. And I was freezing that morning. I was a member of the media then, and I was doing a little radio show in the general vicinity of the Pontiac Silverdome that day. And I remember thinking to myself, the next time I think that Thanksgiving is cold, I'm going to remember today. But the Lions hosted the Broncos in 1999. Yes. The thing I remember about that game is sometimes you have a good game, and sometimes you don't. And that was not a good game that day. That's what I remember about that Denver Bronco victory over the Lions in 99.
No, it wasn't. And they came in and they had the great offensive line coach, Alex Gibb, who had that unique blocking scheme. And it seemed like no matter who Denver put in the backfield, they were going to gain easily over 100 yards. And they're running back. They really, I think Brian Greasy was quarterback that day. And it was a 4 o'clock game. It was later in the day. And they beat us. And we ended up finishing 500 that year, 8-8. But we still made the playoffs only to lose in Washington. I think that was the game we lost in Washington where we had a shell of a backfield and just didn't play well. But yeah, that was not a very memorable Christmas Day game at all for Lions fans.
Yeah, we're very lucky, Bill. We have all these Thanksgiving memories and a lot of good ones, but Christmas Day, not so much. Not so much. And we'll leave it at that.
Yeah,
Bill, I remember the point that 99 team lost their last four games, yeah. And then as you mentioned, that game against Washington in the playoffs. Very frustrating.
Go ahead. We had lost a few years. Remember the 90, what year was it? 95, when we went to Philadelphia and we're losing 35-7 at halftime. That was the game where we almost made the guarantee and we lost. So we're in Washington and they were winning, Sean. I think it was 27-0 at halftime. And I'm, you know, walking in the hallway in the press box at halftime and somebody grabs me on the arm and he goes, Billy, is this Washington or Philadelphia? And it was L. Michaels because he did both games. And he was like, you know, deja vu.
Yeah.
Because it was a similar type of game. I think we scored one touchdown in that game and it was on a blocked punt. I think Ron Rice scored on a blocked punt or something along those lines. But yeah, not a good playoff result for our Lions.
I had to share a quick one with you. My family still jokes about it. I broke out into an impromptu dance on Christmas Day 2004 when Trent Green threw a touchdown to Tony Gonzalez because it clinched our fantasy football league against a mutual friend of ours, Mike Stone. And it was one of those things where it was like I had convinced myself I was going to lose. And then all of a sudden, all right, he hit Gonzo once. And then when he hit him again in the second quarter, I literally just jumped up and just started dancing around the table. And my family still have fun with that to this very day.
And they told the kids, don't worry, he'll be okay.
Hey, Merry Christmas to you and yours, buddy.
You too, Sean. Likewise.
Always a pleasure to chat with you. For Eric Dorch, Merry Christmas to you, my friend, and all of you out there. We'll talk to you next week right here on Gridiron Wrap.